Hello, hello. Welcome to the SBS Cycling Podcast for the week of the 16th of April 2015. This is your weekly review of all things road cycling. I'm Al Hines. This week on the show, the cobbled season comes to a close at Paris-Roubaix, where Giant Alpecin's John Degenkolb collected the first MSR-Roubaix double since the days of Sean Kelly. We'll also be talking train timetabling and some other things about Roubaix. In tech news, the UCI has unveiled plans to explore the possibility to institute disc brakes in the road cycling peloton. We'll discuss their possible merits. And just as the cobbles are behind us, the Ardennes are still ahead. Amstel Gold is on Sunday, and we'll preview that race, which of course will be on SBS. That's all in this week's edition. And with me, it's Rob Arnold and Anthony Tan. No Phil Gomes.
Where is Phil?
We've got an empty seat in his honour. We can sort of sometimes throw things to it, and we'll get like that nice considered silence that he often offers. So it'll be good.
Yeah, he's even more pithy than I am, actually. So I'll have to be a little bit more verbose today.
We'll miss the Canadian accent, but he's busy working on the new website. It's launched on Monday.
Yeah.
Cycling Central.
One of the ironies of going to a new website is that things become less efficient, so you actually need more people to use it.
Well, beta testing. Is that right? No, they've done that already.
I think they've done
they
that.
Don't have the beta tag on it like Cycling News do. I wonder how long they'll have the beta.
They probably just leave it up there until someone notices that it's there still.
I'm sure people notice. It looks different.
You mean the Cycling Central? Just trying to
plug the SBS component of the
Thank
whole
you, Rob.
Concept.
Yeah, no, appreciate that.
No worries.
All right, let's get into it, guys. Let's talk about Paris-Roubaix. I'm sick of this banter. Thank you, Guy. Well, it was one of the biggest groups I've ever seen that left the Arenberg Forest as one and on the Carrefour de l'Arbre, but you were left wondering if the riders themselves knew that they were dangerously close to the finish of the race. Then, finally, Greg Van Avermaet and Yves Lampaert of Quick-Step charged themselves with 15k or so to go, and the race finally stirred into action. Degenkolb saw the danger and closed the gap. Before long, a decisive group, seven riders were clear, with Degenkolb the fastest of the lot. Degenkolb cruised to the line in the sprint, adding that big rock to his palmarès alongside his earlier win this season at Milano San Remo. So it's been a good season for Johnny Degenkolb. Guys, what were your thoughts on Paris-Roubaix, the big one? I suppose we've been hyping it for so long. How did it go?
I didn't find Degenkolb a surprise. I mean, he was in the... I guess I wrote some sort of preview of who might win. I mean, I named six or seven guys, really Matt Hayman I was just throwing in there for old time's sake. I didn't really think he would do anything. But, yeah, I mean, three of those guys I named, they finished on the podium. But, I mean, I think the thing was maybe most impressive was Degenkolb's decision to go alone and then bridge across to those two guys because he realised how dangerous that situation was. And it was, a race losing or race winning scenario for him. So that was impressive for me. I mean, I felt like he rode up until that point. He almost rode Paris-Roubaix like he rode San Remo. I felt he was invisible, almost invisible. He was just always there, but you didn't see him right at the front.
Until he absolutely needed to.
Yes.
It was interesting, I think, were his comments after the race where he said that last year he basically saw the race right away with him, and that was when Terpstra launched that solo move to the finish, and he felt like he paused and waited thinking that someone else would go. This year he said, no, this is the move, and committed fully. And obviously it paid off. I suppose you're right, though, Tanny. It could have gone both ways. That whole group could have come back and maybe he would have been expended. But it was the sort of performance of someone who's learnt from their experience the previous year and doesn't want to be burnt again.
And perhaps a performance from someone who's already won a monument. I mean, sometimes when you have nothing to lose, you can do these things which might have been considered crazy or overly risky, but because he'd won San Remo, it's almost like, well, I can do this stuff.
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing to be... you can't sneeze at the fact when you win a monument, that's extra confidence, extra experience, extra, I don't know, ability to perform, extra backing yourself in that last few kilometres. Rob, what were your thoughts? I mean, it was an interesting Roubaix for me in the sense that... You know, really, those key cobbled sectors that we often talk about, Carrefour de l'Arbre, Arenberger, which I think of late, even the last few years, hasn't been as decisive as it has been yeah, a long time ago.
I know
ago.
What you're saying, but I think, for example, it could have been that Stijn Vandenberg's move with 40-odd kilometres to go was the one that stuck. Like, he's a train. He went like a bat out of hell, and he had a good gap.
We've been trying to build Stijn for a long time,
no,
haven't we?
No, it's not that. I've been saying that why they should give him a go at leadership, and we saw why. He's phenomenal, and he's a force on the bike, and he had a good chance. And we've seen Roubaix's one like that in the past. You know, you can reference O'Grady's, which was another warm day. In April, he went pretty early. Boonen's done that. I think Cancellara's even started, you know, splitting the field early. Even one year, he went straight off the Arenberg and basically just thinned out the bunch all the way through. But I'm going off topic. I think that you sort of referenced the last 15 kilometres as being the real smackdown, but it's not like that because Roubaix is just...
The whole race is a smackdown.
Yeah, exactly. It gets hyped well in advance because it is so interesting from, you know, let's say after 100 kilometres, once they do get to the Pave, then it starts really opening up and it becomes that lottery. I did an interview and we reference Matt Heyman about Roubaix every year with good reason. He's a veteran of it. I think he's done 13 of them. And he told me the thing that he reminds all of his teammates, Mitch Docker and the young guys coming into it, Jens Kirklier, never give up. Never, ever give up because you think, okay, that group's gone. They've got 5 minutes. But that 5 minutes can just disintegrate with mechanicals, a crash, a this or that, and different things can happen. And I know that Matt Wilson was talking with a friend of mine during the race and talking about Jens Kirklier and saying to Vaughan McVilley, listen, we're not going to see much of Jens. He's fired all his bullets and we're not going to see much. And then all of a sudden the next thing that the young Belgian guy did was bridge across to the lead group and that was phenomenal. But it was Degenkolb who did make the race. He animated it for the most important part and proved just how emphatic he is.
Yeah.
And I spoke with Koen de Kort, who rooms with him, and Koen was telling me about the night before when they were discussing what happened the year prior when he came second to a breakaway to Terpstra and how they could alleviate that because Degenkolb's reputation of a sprinter is so strong. And the fact was that they decided, you know, you have to decide which break is going to happen and chase it down. And that's how they did it with Bert de Backer and a great teamwork from John.
It was a little relay move, wasn't it, at the end there?
Yeah, it was
he sort of jumped a little bit off the front and Degenkolb sort of snuck on to his wheel and that was enough to launch him in that final little bit to bridge the gap.
In an ideal world, Degenkolb would have got Van Avermaet and who was he with? Lampard from Quickstep, and it would have been the three of them. But there was that hesitation because it was Degenkolb that brought the group back, and that brought a bigger group to the velodrome and made it...
Not that it mattered really for Degenkolb.
No, not the point, but he still has to account for those people. And as we saw, Van Avermaet had made a good attempt at, or a very quick attempt at boxing him in, which was the only way that Degenkolb was going to be beaten. But Degenkolb was hip to that groove and he moved out straight away and raced like a track specialist.
Yeah. One guy that we talked a lot at length, I suppose, about last week was Alexander Kristoff, and that was for good reason. After his Flanders win, after what he'd done in Drudage, he didn't, I guess, he sort of tape it off. You know, he didn't, I suppose, have quite the form that we were expecting. He was still 10th. Nothing too bad about that. But he didn't, I suppose, live up to the expectation. Tanny, was it just sort of a matter of one race too many in his legs, do you think?
I don't know, because he didn't seem to be as sharp as he was in San Remo. Yes, he finished second, but he just didn't seem as sharp as last year. And he did say that, you know, he had prepared himself so he would be good for Flanders and Roubaix this year rather than good right at the start from San Remo. So I don't know, but yeah, I agree with you. I didn't see the guy he was just struggling to follow moves rather than making moves like he did in Flanders. I mean, can you lose... I don't know if you can lose form in a week.
No, I think it was just the circumstance of the race.
Do you think it was a factor, Rob, sorry to cut you off, but do you think it was a factor of, you know, we often, I suppose, forget about the fact that you put huge amounts of exertion into a race like the Tour of Flanders, and he didn't just win it, but he was actually in a break for the best part of the last 20Ks with Nicky Terpstra, another guy who obviously won last year and, again, wasn't in the top 10 at
Roubaix. And he also raced and won 3 days of the Pan and did not, you know... massive sprints and he put on a big show there. So, but maybe he's just said, look, you know, I know after Roubaix I'm finished for a little while, so let's just race the hell out of myself. And he did. You know, you'd think after if you won the Tour of Flanders and were favourite for Paris-Roubaix, you'd think he'd have a break in the middle, but he didn't. He raced 3 days. It's not bad.
But I mean, I suppose interestingly, in contrast, Degenkolb had an unlucky Flanders, I suppose, in some ways, because I think he got caught behind. But ultimately, that meant that he then didn't go full gas, and he still got, I mean, you could say he didn't burn matches that he then used at Roubaix. I mean, sure. I don't know if there's anything to that, but...
Yeah, I just think it's because, I mean, we just also have to remember that, you know, it's only once in a generation that you have, or twice in a generation, you have riders like Bonan and Cancellara who can double up. These other guys, they're just not...
They're human.
They're not indomitable like those guys were in their heyday. You know, Bonan in the mid... Cancellara just basically trading monuments in the mid-2000s.
All right, I think it's a really cool generation at the moment. And okay, we've said farewell to Wigo from the World Tour, and he'd gone in as a much hyped-up candidate for Paris-Roubaix, and with good reason. You know, he put on a good show last year, and he did just miss that move like that Degenkolb missed last year when Terpstra went. Otherwise, you know, he might have been better placed even. And he made a big show of it, and he was a marked man. When he did come off that one sector about 16 or 17 kilometres from the finish, he put on a big time trial effort as though, okay, I know this is my farewell. I'm going to have a real good go at it. And you could see that he rode everyone off his wheel. I think we could, you know, tip our hat to what Wigo did. I think it was impressive.
Wiggins certainly had form. You know, we knew that going in from the time trial he did at Dupont. Do you think, Tanny, I mean, maybe I'll throw this to you, but do you think maybe there was too much from him too early? It was like, I think it was about 40, 45 kilometres that he went out and had a go.
I think without that, we would have seen a win from Stijn Vandenberg. I think that was the catalyst to get everyone else on the
Jeez,
go.
Jeez, you like Stijn Vandenberg, Rob. I never saw that.
Everyone underestimates him.
Yeah, well, perhaps including his team. Until he's put in a position where he's a protected rider, I don't think you'll see him win one of these big races.
No, this isn't the discussion about Vandenberg. I'm talking about what Wigo did when he came off that sector of cobbles and lit it up and chased. And he chased with all his might. It was...
No, I mean, the thing is, we're talking about Wiggins, but you referenced Vandenberg, and I just think, these guys, I mean, you look at Wiggins, he had basically a whole team supporting him. If you look at why, you know, if we analyse why Etik's Quickstep didn't win...
No, he did that for other races.
You know, I just think they just don't have a guy...
They don't have that Bonan guy.
They need a guy with a fast finish, and then without Bonan, they don't have that.
Completely changes the dynamic.
Yeah, regarding Wiggins, I liked the move that he made. He just needed someone to go with him. And he just lacks a bit of experience. I mean, we have to remember he's only... done one full classics campaign and that before prior to this year, and that was last year. I think he's still learning, and the sad part is that he will no longer learn the classics because he's not going to ride them anymore.
It's an interesting one because it was almost like you felt, you know, I know he said he's retiring, but you just feel like he maybe could have had another year or another couple of years of almost just looking at it like, I think it was maybe Carnarvon or De Jong used to, towards the end of their career, or maybe Frederik Gesdon, they almost did their entire race season was almost 3 months, you know, and that was something that, I don't know, I mean, it's obviously, Wiggins has obviously wanted to step away from the road and focus on the track, fair enough, but you almost want to tempt him to go, well, maybe you should have a look. Anyway.
I reckon there'd be people pulling him in every direction, and I think good on him for at least, you know, picking out objectives and doing, you know, he's listed his date for the hour record. What is it?
20th
something
of June?
Yeah. No, I think it's a bit earlier
in
June.
No, it's like the 2nd of June.
On the Wigo topic, I'd just like to say a little reference to... You've been referring throughout the classics commentary that we've done on the podcast about this changing of the generation. I thought what we saw in Luke Rowe was an outstanding effort from a domestique who ended up in the top 10. I think he ended up 8th.
Yep.
And he was the best of the next group, and he'd spent his whole day doing everything that Wiggins would want of him, and more, and he put on he was impressive. And I wonder, you know, he's another guy that we're going to consider for the future. We're going to talk about him.
Although, I mean, to throw that back at you, though, Rob, I mean, Luke Rowe, and I'm not taking anything away from Luke, but the guys that beat him, Dagan Kolb, he's fresh face as well at 26.
Yes, 100%.
If you look Stibar is a fresh face. Cooklier, reasonably fresh.
Yep.
And Christoph himself is only, I think he's turning 27 this year. So there's plenty of this whole top 10, I think, speaks to the fact that maybe we've got lots to look forward to in the next few years. Guys, I want to talk about Van Avermaet, because this is the guy that is a perennial runner-up. And I feel like, again, like last year's Flanders, where he just threw it all on the line, this year at Roubaix again, he was the one that made that move. And fair enough, maybe he needed to be the one that made the move. But you just feel for the guy, because you feel like he did everything that in his power to put himself in the best possible position to win. And again, I don't know how many times we're going to say this, but again,
he lost.
He came up short, yeah.
Yeah, I have this sort of... you speak about the change of generation, like I'm not sure how you phrase it out with regards to these new breed, but I think it's more that the theme of the classics for me is that, you know, the pure sprinters don't win much. Have you noticed, like, the guys like Cavendish and Kittel, they're not winning much? Okay, there's injuries and things like that, but if you sort of analyse it a bit more deeply, I mean, the guys who are taking their spot are guys who can now get over the climbs quite well, who can save themselves quite well, who can make moves like Dagan Kolb did in Paris-Roubaix. The pure sprinter can't do that, so it's almost like a
but that's not new.
No, I think, but you look at the, I guess, yeah,
classics
there was
aren't for the sprinters. That was never, has that ever been considered the case?
Yeah, you had guys like, you know, in Bonnen in his heyday, he's winning classics and he's winning stages in the Tour de France. So I'm just saying, I think, there's a theme of all these guys doing, you know, who winning sprints and also being able to win a monument, like a very difficult monument, like whether it be Gent-Wevelgem or Roubaix or Flanders.
One final thing to talk about, which we haven't talked about at all, and was, I suppose,
a shadow of Paris-Roubaix.
A shadow on the race in some ways, because it did, I think Paolini actually threw out a whole lot of tweets and said he was actually disappointed that one of the things we were talking about after Roubaix was this, which was this train level crossing closed, TGV going through, and half the peloton. Well, no, maybe half the peloton was in the fine. Probably the end half was very borderline, and I think a third got, you know, goodbye. I think this is a real frustration for a lot of people, because whether you think that the rider should have stopped or not, that we're in these sort of major races, and this Paris-Roubaix is one of the major races of the season, and we're having to contend with something as trivial.
I can give you some, not my first-hand perspective, but I was given one by Kundercourt. And he was telling me, he was in the group that went through early. And he reminded me, this is a couple of things that we may not take into consideration when you just see the footage of them stopped or stopping, or as the case may be, not stopping. He said he was in the early part of the peloton, and he was at pains to point out that the crossing was in the middle of it might have been in the one cobbled sector, but there was one cobbled sector and then another one very quickly after the Pont Gibus, I think it was. And he came up and he was concentrating so hard on the pavé and the wheel in front and all the circumstance of the race that the only time that he was aware that there was a crossing was that when the boom gate on the first side of the road
began to slowly lower.
Almost, he could see it in his periphery vision. But other than that, he said there was no way that you could hear the bells. It's not like it was, you know, you're out on a training ride and you hear ding, 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 and you know that it's the train coming. He said he was not even aware that there was a train track nearby. And he was literally a couple of metres from crossing the tracks.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And then secondly, once it did go, it was neutralised to the point where, because I raised the issue of the neutralisation that Bernard Eisel had spoken about in Gent-Wevelgem because of the strong winds, and I said, is it a similar situation where the bike riders could act as a unit? And he said, we very much did, but we were also forced to, because the neutralisation wasn't a rider's initiative, it was the race organiser's initiative, and they had two motos at the front of that the bunch that did get through, and they basically said, you stay behind us, otherwise you're out of the race for sure, because we've neutralised it until the group comes back.
Yep.
So Kuhn was there and he went through the reference points of how these things happen. Okay, he wasn't in that last group which was battling for do we go under the boom gate or not.
Yeah, I suppose it's all, you know, that's all well and good. That debate, you know, will hash out, you know, whether these riders should have gone forward, how that should have worked out. I think the broader point, you know, if we're going to talk big picture, is how is it that we're in a situation where a TGV train is cutting the course of, I know that course normally every day of the year is just the train line, but
what are you
equally
going to do? Stop the SNCF from sending trains along a train line?
Well, I mean, all you're really asking is a 5-minute, like, you know, a early enough delay around that to say, well, this is when
you,
the
you
course is going to be cut.
You think a train timetable could be changed,
I think
you
can say that if you consider that that is the problem. But when you think about
Paris-Roubaix
and
France,
all of the things, yeah, all of the things that are done, that's phenomenal what is done.
Totally.
And
but
to
I'm not
say
saying
that they should also coordinate with the SNCF, the train company.
I think they already do
to stop
speak,
it.
They do already communicate a lot with the trains and the SNCF. I just think that it's one of those things where, you know, even funnier that, well, not funnier, but bizarre that the SNCF then came up with a strong statement about how it was, you know, irresponsible when perhaps, you know, they are totally aware that this is going on. I'm sure they would well and truly know, and yet it's just kind of like, well, business as usual. I mean, there's almost like a blinkered view from both, like from the SNCF and from Roubaix.
I'm
just
sure
going,
there's a reason. Like if they stopped that train and said, okay, the peloton's going to come past, who knows, there might have been a train accident. There's got to be logic to it.
I don't know, maybe
because
that, you know, when you have a guidebook for a race, we get the slower schedule, the medium, and then the fastest. So if that window happened to be about 20 minutes, say,
yeah, it wouldn't be a lot more than that.
Yeah, I mean, these train controllers divert trains, stop trains, pause trains,
delay slightly,
yes,
increase speed off
all the time. So yeah. I just don't see it how it would be unreasonable ask to say, okay, just don't have any trains going for a 15 to 20 minute period.
As a cycling commentator, I cannot offer input into how trains run or a train timetable.
You can still have an opinion though, Rob.
I have an opinion. And I think Christian Prudhomme, the director of the race, came out and said, look, if we eliminated some of the train crossings, of railway crossings from the race, then we'd eliminate some very famous sectors of Kapave. So they can eliminate the train passage.
But again, I'm not saying that that's the solution either. I'm saying that what, you know, the SNCF needs potentially to be said, well, why don't we just figure out a system where you're not running?
I understand your point, but I'm also trying to be the voice of reason to say, you know, they've organised so much already.
Well, I think as far as I'm concerned, you're standing on the fence on just going, well, I don't want to commit to an opinion here. Surely you would.
Since the beginning of cycle racing,
yeah,
there's been train crossing, railway crossings, and when it happened when Cancellara won, and the people who were actually in contention for the title at a crucial point of the race was stopped, that was a circumstance of the race. That's what is written into the rule books, is that a railway crossing is a circumstance of the race.
But history isn't like a precedent for everything that happens in the future. I mean, just because it's like, this is like saying that, you know, we rode the Tour de France back in the day with, you know, no neutral service, but now we have neutral service.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm just saying, like, yeah, there's no reason.
I do have a strong point on it, and I think that they tried to do everything right and people got caught up in a sense of panic.
Yeah.
And it was very unfortunate that it happened, but it was, thankfully, no one got hurt, which was...
Well, that is totally, totally true, I suppose.
And I don't think the train was going full speed because it would have been in a blink of an eye. But I think it was more dramatic that it was a TGV and that you got pictures with the TGV, which we know goes over 300k an hour.
Just slipping by.
It wasn't...
But it was not at full speed for certain.
No, but how quickly could it stop? Because the time between I saw some of the last riders go over that crossing and the train, going across that particular crossing, there wasn't long. I mean, I think there was almost a collective gasp at just how short it was and what may have transpired. And that's what I was going.
I almost got hit last night. I crossed on a green pedestrian light and a car went through a red light and missed me by a foot. And I can tell you I had visions of what would have been.
Did it feel like a TGV?
It was frightening as hell. It was frightening as hell. And if you see a train coming on and you're on a bike and you're clipped in and you're sort of, even or Damar, who got stuck on the other side, you know, and he had to sort of somehow duck under the French champion. He had to duck under the boom gate. When that train came past, I bet he was in this right state of shock.
I mean, perhaps those white French champion shorts became slightly browner. Anyway, whatever.
But it definitely was a talking point, and it got all of the mainstream media saying Paris-Roubaix.
Well, we're talking about it.
But they didn't talk about John Degenkolb.
No, which I think that's what Paolini said. And if you can look up Paolini, there was a good article done by Cycling News which collated all of Paolini's tweets. It was a long line of tweets about it. And his biggest bemoaning was that the race had been totally overshadowed by a really silly incident. Anyway, guys, let's move on from talking about Paris-Roubaix. Just a recap for anyone that did miss it. Degenkolb was first over the line. Stibar, ZNX Stibar, which we didn't talk about much at all, was second. And Greg Van Avermaet of BMC was third. Not totally unrewarded for the Belgium. And don't forget, you can catch up with all the action from Paris-Roubaix on Cycling Central and SBS On Demand. Well, early this week, the UCI released a statement from On Height Agile HQ that it was experimenting with the use of disc brakes on road bikes with a view to introducing them, the decades-old tech, into the professional road peloton. Cookson said, although disc brakes have been used for around a decade in mountain biking, for the last 2 years in cyclocross, the introduction to road cycling must be carefully studied in collaboration with all those who are directly concerned. Fellas, this is obviously... as I said, it's decades-old technology, so it's not like anything new in terms of what they are or what they do. That it's taken this long, I suppose, for us to even have this discussion is probably symptomatic of what cycling is. But it is still divisive, Rob. It's a divisive topic. A lot of people don't like disc brakes at all for various reasons, from safety concerns to the purists who want a bike to be a bike. They don't want it to move too far away from its original design. There's, you know, concerns about how, from a technical limitation point of view, how you're going to change wheels as quickly. They don't deal with quick release as easily. You know, it cuts both ways.
Everyone who published about it, and we did the same. We didn't get a huge reaction on Facebook, but we posted a couple of things that were relevant, like an interview with Gary Blem, who's a mechanic for Team Sky, and I was talking to him earlier this year about the introduction of disc brakes, and he raised a couple of pertinent issues. First of all, there's various sizes of the rotor, so you've got to get more of a standardised size so that there can be a neutral spares option, because you'd still need neutral spares. That's something that's agreed. Even if it's in the one team that is doing the wheel change, which is largely the case in road racing at that level, then they need to understand what rotor size they're going to use. There could be a through axle, which is a different fastening system to the usual quick release. There's a multitude of things to consider before we talk about just the application of the disc brakes. We've had a number of... We test a lot of bikes at our magazine, and we've had a number through with disc brakes. And I can see why they're being marketed, because there's a groundswell of people in the marketplace wanting disc brakes on road bikes. So that's great. Is it necessary in racing? I don't think so. I'm unaware of why people would like it, but I've ridden both, and on a road bike, I still maintain that the caliper brake is just fine. And especially there's improvements in the caliper brake where they're direct mounting it to the frame that's giving you a stronger stopping. You don't really need stronger stopping than what we're getting. I guess people are wanting to be
able... No, because that's the thing. People forget that the stronger stopping you have at some point, it's not the stopping power that gives way. It's your wheel underneath you, because you lose traction.
Well, also, yeah, exactly. There's no ABS in it, is there? So, but, you know, Campagnolo not so long ago went from a dual pivot caliper to a single pivot for the rear, because they thought that the stopping power was too strong. But that's one line of argument. So let's be clear, you can stop your road bike pretty well. Some people would like it to be with the disc brakes, but you have hydraulic fluid that you need to activate the mechanism. And I think that's when things become very complicated. And it's also really cool. Like, it's really cool tech. Trust me, I like it. But I'm happy with me as a person who rides road bikes often. I like to ride with a cable and a caliper. Suits me just fine.
Yeah, it's interesting as well that...
But there's a lot of people who want it the other way around. And that it comes to racing now is good for the companies that are trying to sell this product. Mm. But it's sort of, to me, like an answer to a question that no one asked.
I think it's kind of like this debate between the avant-garde and the purists. I just like the simplicity of a bike with single or dual pivot brakes. I don't subscribe to this...
stem-mounted gear levers.
And... I don't even use a bike computer. I mean, just don't see the point. I mean, you can work out... I don't use Strava. I don't use any of that crap. I just think that, you know, if you look at... Okay, the... Aside from our personal opinions, I mean, just if you look at all the crashes that occurred in the World Tour racing over the course of a calendar year, how many were caused by the brakes not functioning as they should? Probably, I don't know, one or two, I'd imagine. It's not because of the lack of stopping power. As Rob mentioned, the dual pivot brakes, when they were introduced, I don't know, 20-odd years ago, they provide a huge amount of stopping power. Yeah. I mean, you can go from...
Don't talk to me about wet weather. I mean, it doesn't take long for these calipers to work in wet weather as well.
No, you just change the brake pads as well if you're using carbon rims or whatever. I just don't...
There is a difference, let's be clear, but the disc brake benefit is negligible.
But number of accidents.
Heavy wet weather.
As in, like, you know, sort of quite bad rain, I could imagine that disc brakes would have a... not substantial, but significant performance.
But not enough
performance
to
edge.
Make it like a... It's not a...
But I suppose the question then would be, you know, giving teams and riders the option.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what they're trying to do. But it's going to be interesting to see what the uptake is. I've got the option of riding both. I can tell you what I'm going to take.
Mm. I think that's a bad idea, giving people options, because you're going to have a peloton of, say, 200 riders and just say they all have to brake very suddenly en masse. So you're going to get some who are braking much quicker than others and others less so. I think that's going to create...
Actually, the modulation's pretty similar.
Yeah.
It's not a... you know, I've ridden both and there's not a big difference. They both pull you up. If you want to skid with one, you can. If you want to skid with the other, likewise. But I don't know. I just think it's... I wrote a piece in my magazine about the most enduring cycling product, and I came to the conclusion, this is just my world, that it's Vans shoes, because the tread has, by that I mean the one product that has remained unchanged. People came back and said, no, but it's tyres. No, one product that remains unchanged. Mm. And I referenced in that this push for disc brakes, and I did so because I was told by someone in the industry who's close to disc brakes, no, we don't need them at all. But... if we introduce them, then we can sell more bikes. Mm. It's a market driven thing that benefits the industry, or is it the industry thing that benefits the market?
Well, I mean, I would add on ING onto the end of that. I think it's a marketing driven thing.
Yeah, you look at carbon bikes and you say, I mean, you know, they're on trend, but I suppose they were even more on trend, I reckon, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and now there's almost a push back to people getting, you know, bespoke titanium frames and steel frames and old school looking
trend.
Classic.
Yeah. But already Shimano, which released disc brakes years ago, and we've seen all of the major suppliers come forward. Actually, Campag's still a little bit behind, but sign of the times. But Shimano's already refined their disc brake, let's say caliper, the little thing on the frame, so that it can be direct mount to the frame, and no frame manufacturer has yet built one for it. It was released this week. So they're refining the tech, and it's going to be great. Don't worry. The weight isn't an issue so much as it was once before. It's just servicing, neutral servicing. Mm. Servicing in the peloton is less relevant because they've got professional mechanics, but in the general market, people who are buying the bike, they're going to find it more difficult to serve as a hydraulic disc brake than they do a cable action or whatever. That then we reference mountain biking and disc brakes absolutely dominate that market. Although it's interesting, totally different horses for courses.
In mountain bikes, yes, but interesting that they reference cross even in the UCI's release. And I'm pretty sure that in quite a few of the World Cups and even the World Championships, it's not like they're all using disc brakes. You know, if you actually look at it, even there they're using the dual caliper systems because they understand the way that works in certain conditions can be less, you know, I suppose, especially with disc.
And that's a cantilever system, which I can tell you is rank. It doesn't really stop you very well at all.
Yeah, but that's the way they've grown up and that's the way they've always used them. And in fact, they're basically saying, well, we're at the top of the game and we're still using these other systems. So anyway, I think the jury's going to be out. And even if they do some testing and find it, I'm not sure what the conclusion is going to necessarily be other than, well,
I think the conclusion will be Shimano is a good sponsor of the UCI.
I think the bike shops love disc brakes because, as Rob mentioned, that they're not as easily serviced. You can't just do it yourself unless you're quite mechanically minded.
And we know that most cyclists these days aren't.
Where do the margins in the bike shops these days? It's in servicing. It's not in selling bikes. Everyone's trying to screw each other.
Well, if disc brakes being people back to the local bike shop, then it serves a good purpose.
All right, let's leave the disc brake debate there because I think you're right, Rob. There is going to be no conclusion.
It's endless.
All right. Thank you, Guy. Well, Wednesday evening in the lands of Europe, Brabant's Peel, which is sort of the semi-lead-in to the proper Ardennes Classics, took place, and it was a BMC man that took the win, Ben Hermans, ahead of Michael Bling Matthews and Philippe Gilbert. Gilbert obviously won Amstel Gold last year, and he will go into this Sunday's edition as one of the key favourites. But look, Australia has a very good chance in Michael Matthews, guys. Amstel Gold, been around for a long time. It always reminds me of that big beer thing that they give at the end, and Amstel beer, which I didn't really even, wasn't even that intimate with, but until I suppose the race, and then I was more intimate with it because it felt like every time I drink it, it was something to do with cycling. Anyway,
move on.
Good. 258 kilometres, Maastricht to the Kouberg, basically. You do the Kouberg three times, I believe, and on these big circuits, they become smaller.
It is so confusing.
The race works. And if you look at the map...
Don't try and follow the race from above.
No.
Because you'll get a headache.
You will get lost, guaranteed.
If you had a child drawing spirals on a map, you would get a similar course design to Amstel Gold. The Kouberg is sort of, I suppose, the end climb. And then they've got that little sort of plateau at the end. So it's not... You can't just get over the climb. You actually have to crest it and then go a little bit further, which makes it sort of a tantalizing prospect, that last little maybe kilometre.
It is a good race, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite interesting. I don't think it gets anywhere near as much cred as a classic as it perhaps should.
I think it's perhaps because it's one of the youngest.
It's 50 years old this year. It's the big anniversary. I remember when I started following the classics and Italian journalists would scoff at it. And Belgian journalists would be like, this young upstart race. But it's 50 years old now. They were comparing it with Milan-San Remo and the monuments, which are the five.
Mm. Actually, that's interesting. Yeah, when I covered Amstel Gold, I did notice that was in the mid-2000s. There's actually very few Italian journalists there.
Italians still were winning, like Damiano Cunego and those guys.
Rebellion.
Yeah.
I think he won a couple. He will be back this year, actually, among others.
Davide Rebellin is the what's it called when someone just keeps on keeping on?
Well, yeah.
Jens Voigt, isn't that the name for it?
Or recidivist, if he's still doping.
Yeah, he's always around, and of course he's disgraced after his Olympic performance.
I believe we can reference the Brabantse Pale because he was in the top 10 there.
He was in the top 10 at Brabant, so he's obviously in reasonable form.
Imagine if he wins it.
It would not be ideal.
What team is he with? It's with CCC Polestar.
Yeah, it's that hybrid team that's been around for quite some time now. But I think it's a Polish team.
Yeah. They're going to the Giro.
Yeah.
So maybe Rebellin's just going to keep on keeping on.
Oh, look, I hope
it's the Polish version of that Gianni Savio's Venezuelan makeup, you know, Androni Giocattoli.
Venezuela.
I won't reference what Wigo called it once upon a time, but anyway.
Team with a billion sponsors.
So who's the winner? Like, did you watch this Brabantse Pale? That was a stunning race. I thought we saw Dave Tanner in the action. He was away with Ben Hermans.
Yeah.
And then we saw that. The cheek of the man. I was a bit cranky, and then I read afterwards the comments. But Phil Gill was chasing down his teammate. I thought, that's not very nice.
I thought he was going to do the sort of the old catapult, the old Madison sling
at the end.
Well, I thought maybe he would bridge, Hermans would throw everything and he'd keep going. But then it turned out that Gil didn't quite have the stamina of old.
It looked like Flanders versus Denoir.
Yeah. And then, although he ended up finishing on the podium. Yeah. So it was kind of impressive for him to surge that close to the finish and then still have the ability to come back to the peloton, regroup.
And who was stuck in the sandwich between those BMC guys?
Some guy called Michael Matthews.
Michael Matthews.
Yeah.
I just to digress to go forward.
You always talk about Michael Matthews. So
no, that's we were talking
more
about
than Stijn Vandenberg.
We were talking about Matthews and Degenkolb and different people, and so I pulled up the photo of the road race of the under 23s in Geelong in 2010, which was won by Michael Matthews, and second was Degenkolb, and third was Taylor Finney and Guillaume Bovin from Canada. They had an equal for third place. We don't know what happened with Guillaume. He hasn't really gone.
But the other three guys.
Taylor, we know he's in a he's had a terrible leg accident. But isn't it amazing that within those 5 years, these guys are fed income classics candidates and winners in the case of Degenkolb?
No, absolutely. We should probably mention Nathan Haas was up there in the final. He could be up there at Amstel as well. He was up there
in Milan-San Remo. He's up there in Brabant.
Strada Bianche. I don't know.
These are races that he's talked about.
Love that guy. I wish he'd just win one race in Europe would be rad because he keeps winning Japan Cup.
Yeah, I mean that's no one's going to remember you for winning Japan Cup multiple times.
No, I think Japanese people might.
Yeah, well, you go to Japan and be a hero.
Yeah.
Yeah, they love you. I'm not sure whether Haas knows what type of rider he is just yet. I mean, yeah, it might take a couple more years.
He's still relatively young in his overall development. One guy as well, I suppose, again, we're being a bit biased to the Australians, but Simon Gerrans will be in attendance at Armstrong.
I think they should ride for Bling. Oh, I called him that. Michael Matthews.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's probably the correct way to go about things. It'd be interesting to see where Gerrans is in his form because he had those two setbacks, the collarbone and then the elbow at Strada Bianca. So he's now, I don't know, his form is a real question mark. We've never really seen Gero, and it's been a long time, I think, since we've seen Gero in this position where he's not been at least going reasonably well come spring.
Yeah, but as we transfer from the cobbles and the nastiness of Flanders and Roubaix to the Ardennes, then we see a whole new different wave of riders. Like we see Albasini on the list with OGE as well.
Yep.
He's done really well in those races before and we could see it again. And there's big range.
Dan Martin, Joaquin Rodriguez, Roman Kreuziger.
There's that guy Nibali. I've heard of him.
Yeah, we have heard of him. And what's going on with that Astana? I mean, that Astana thing, that's going to be visited again and again and again. Anyway,
going on with that UCI thing? Yeah, what happens with
this? They announce these reviews and then nothing really happens. Maybe, guys, quickly, maybe just a tip for Sunday and we'll leave it there.
Oh, Al, you put me on the spot. Oh, I don't know. God. I don't know.
Well, given that Rodriguez won Catalunya. No, he didn't win Catalunya. He won Pays Vasco. And he wasn't expecting to. He had a good time trial. He's on the list, so he's come up to form. He might be old, mid-30s, late 30s. But he's still kicking there.
I'll say Albasini. Because I don't think Guerra will be good enough to win.
I'm going with Tom Dumoulin.
Tom Dumoulin.
We'll keep the giant Alpecin run going.
And I might go for Matthews, I think, and we'll see how that plays out. But that may be a stretch. We'll see. I think he's obviously seems to be in pretty good nick.
I think the Dutchie, old Tom.
Tommy D.
Yeah.
He's an underrated rider as well, I think.
We're
astounded. We're going to see a lot of him. We're going to see heaps of him. He's second in the world.
He's going on one of those naked calendars, is he? Or
oh, God, don't go there. You always just sort of go at the end of these things.
No, but you said we're going to see a lot of him. I don't know what you're talking about.
There are the cycle passion calendars.
In the bike racing world.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
What's the antonym of passion, because we've got the cycle passion calendars, so you'd have to.
What about Kwiatkowski? Are we going to say him just because we say him every other time? Day he'll do it again like he did at the World.
Yeah, yeah. And then we'll talk about Simon Gerrans' silver medal. That'll be up in next week's podcast, no doubt.
We'll never talk about Simon's silver medal.
Guys,
I've moved on from that.
Thank you, as always. It has been a pleasure. Guy, that'll do us, I think. Thanks everyone for joining us. Don't forget, for all your news, blogs, videos, pics and more, we're always online creating content at sbs.com.au/cyclingcentral, which has a new look. And if you want to find the podcast, it's also on soundcloud.com/cycling-central. Thanks again, and bye for now.